Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter at securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Yeah, so it's been about a year, I think, since we dropped an episode. We've recorded a few, but have hadn't had time to edit them. I don't know if they'll see the light of day. They're not timely anymore, so maybe we'll see. it's been a long year. I know that between Eric and Brian and I, there's been a lot going on, and I guess I'll start just quickly and say, you know, I'm now on a planned hiatus. I'm spending some time with my family. I used to think that this was a phrase that people used as a cover for I had a bad breach and I'm no longer employed at the place, or I annoyed the guy I worked for and they let me go. But I can safely say this is it is absolutely a true statement. Maybe it's not always used genuinely, but there definitely comes a time when you say I need to spend more time with the people I love and the people that live with me and put up with me and come out of the basement. I had this moment about maybe 5 months ago when my Apple Watch said a new trend has been detected in your activity levels. Your new average daily caloric expense, like what you're expending, has lowered to 150 calories per day. And that... That's not good, because it means I got up, I rolled out, I went into my chair in this office here, and I didn't get out until about 7 o'clock, and then I was so bedraggled from days of Zoom meetings and things and that I didn't do anything more. So
Zoom is the silent killer, is what you're saying.
Well, Teams really, because Teams also gets you mentally as well as lethargically, but Zoom gets you just lethargically.
Yeah, I thought we were going to go on like it's Zoom, Teams, no, Zoom, yes.
Zoom, yes. I mean, honestly, to quote my father, everything in moderation, Daniel. But what it means is that we're re-jumpstarting the network. We're re-jumpstarting Distilling Security. We're bringing the podcast back, as evidenced by this episode when it hits the light of day. And we're going to work on some new things. We're working on some sponsorships. We're working on some new shows, which will likely show up after the first of the year. So subscribe now to the network and you'll get notified. And I'm really excited about getting to take a little time away as an operator and put some focus on other ways that I can help the community for the next few months. I don't know what happens after that, but we'll figure it out. Eric, what have you been up to for the last year?
I may have stepped into a little bit broader role than just security, moving into the CTO space, which is super cool transition. Very, very interesting going from being focused on, not that security goes away, right? But going kind of being focused on the security space and then expanding to broader IT, which is super cool. Because if you think about it, security has a unique view across the organization, right? You got to be plugged in. Good security teams have view across the organization. And we've mentioned it in all of our past episodes. I'm talking about understanding the business because that gives you context to what's going on. Right. So how being able to take that and expand it in, instead of playing the influence role of having more direct control over where we're going. Super interesting. It's fun. Economic headwinds, which makes things a little bit more interesting.
Right. In a consumer business.
But we've been doing that from a security perspective for the longest time.
True. Right?
There was only a small period where all of a sudden budgets really opened up and then they contracted right back down. So used to this environment.
Wow. Well, congrats. That's a wonderful
thank you.
That's a wonderful change. And yeah, we like to joke that CISOs make the best CIOs and CTOs. So
in today's age, like Eric, I always joke like security. I don't joke. I'm dead honest when I say
you
this.
Never
security
joke.
15, 20 years ago was like firewalls, right? And you had security right. over here. You had the IT team over here. And then like 10 to 5 years ago, it started to like become like a Venn diagram. You know, the thumbs were kind of overlapping. And today it's completely overlapping. So to bring somebody that understood all of this, and now that it's overlapping and teams want to sprint, right, and move faster, marketing teams want to do this, right? AI, we're going to go ahead and just write AI on everything we do. Like I guarantee probably even in the cabinet industry, you're like, dude, we just sold a cabinet with AI. We just
these
wrote
hinges,
it on the back.
These hinges have AI.
We got 15% uplift, right? Because we got AI cabinets. And for those of you listening, we're probably going to add AI to the podcast, you know, the great security debate.ai. Right?
We are AI.
I'm already agentic AI. It's not really Dan. It's just a model of me.
Yeah, 100%. And so like when Dan said, or Eric said he graduated from the basement, like for those of you that last saw me, I was in the basement. I lived in a cave. I had been moved down there by the family during COVID. And what started as we'll set this up for like a year turned into like 5 years. And I'm now putting together an office. So
that's awesome.
I'm like staring up, right? So, and I don't have to like hide the fact that it's open ceilings and there's stuff hanging.
So you're saying there's hope I might someday exit the basement too?
There is a chance, Dan. There is a chance. And not to give too much away of where I'm at, I didn't graduate that far. I'm basically above the garage now. Woo! Winning.
As
Winning.
Long as nobody comes home during the podcast recording, no one will know the difference.
100%. So a lot of change, right?
Yeah.
And I would say for the better. So it's great to get back together because Dan, I think you and I just saw each other in person 3 days ago as I'm trying to build out my network.
And note the, network, note the nerdery over people. Your left shoulder there.
Oh yeah. Look at that one cord plugged in.
It's a gateway drug.
I'm gonna try to
you'll be there
put together the most broken backwards infrastructure I can and then come back to it with security protocols and be like, man, why is this network so messed up? Just as like a training exercise of something we can talk about on future dates.
Because you used Elmer's glue to splice those Ethernet cables. Don't do that.
Yeah. I got a lot of glue. A lot of duct tape. A lot of tape.
Well, it's been a busy week, guys. There's a lot going on in the world. Actually, let's call it 2 weeks. I don't know about you, but this has been the best advertisement for business continuity plans over the last 2 weeks that I've ever had. I've had the maybe I spend too much time with insurance people, but I've been having the 100 years, 1,000 years flood discussion with people about, you know, to what level do you want to build your resiliency? For those that don't know, in the insurance world, they talk about things like the, you know, the highest flood level in the last 50 years and the highest flood level in the last 100 years. And those in theory are less and less likely numbers. That highest number over 100 shouldn't happen in the for the next 100 years. But in risk management, yeah, shouldn't happen. But in risk management, yeah, we always have to figure out how big we want to plan for, because you could plan for the catastrophe of Godzilla attacks New York, but the likelihood is pretty low, we hope. But I think with both AWS, US East 1 taking a major outage, and a large chunk of Azure taking an outage in the last 2 weeks, I know that I, and you know, we security people are notorious for getting amped up over things like this, but I think I've taken a more risk averse posture in the last 10 days than I have in a long time about cloud services. And I think it's starting to change how I recommend or to what level of flood we start to think about protecting things. I don't know. I think I've already started to clamp down on more things. I've started to talk about, you know, greater resiliency, greater redundancy, multi-cloud strategies, or even there was a great post by DHH from 37 Signals about returning their stuff back out of the cloud and the cost save. It was mostly about cost savings, but, you know, are we to that point where cloud is no longer reliable?
It depends. I just wanted to be the first one.
That's my line.
I was trying to pull up this article because I used it a long time ago to talk about, and there was a city in Kentucky, not Louisville, small town. And when you just said like planning, right? There was a massive flood. I think it was like back in like 1937, right? And devastated the city, and the Army Corps of Engineers came in like the 40s or 50s. I'll find it. But they looked at it and said, okay, was that like a once in a lifetime occurrence, right? And what would, you know, if that was the highest, where do we build to, right? And they were like, yeah, but to build that high cost X. And they're like, right, but in the next 50 years, if the city grows, like here's what it's going to protect on this side, right? So there was the first stage where built up water comes in, and then that second stage. And what ended up happening, I think it was 2023 or 24, massive floods, massive rains came through, and it literally was like an inch underneath and protected, you know, 50,000 plus people. And it was all because...
I'm just envisioning Brian singing the old song from Vacation Bible School, like the rains came down and the floods came.
Yeah. And it takes one person in the room to stand up and say, I disagree though. Here's why we should do this. Right. And they did. So to your point, like when you're building in that resiliency, and I think a lot of the conversation that I've seen lately is on that. And I always pronounce this wrong. The repatriation,
bringing back
on the hardware side,
to bring back. Yeah.
And you're starting to see that big shift now over the last year, year and a half, right? Of not going full cloud. Yeah. You're operating in the cloud, but you also have, what's your fallback in terms of a hybrid or a colo, or what is it that you're doing?
This is why though, I say it depends in jest, but there's some seriousness to it, right? Because if we take the broad brush approach to our organizations, it doesn't make any sense. But understanding the context of the different nuances on the business, like if I think about for us, manufacturing has to be up. For manufacturing to be down, super high cost because you're still paying people, you're still running machinery, but you're not producing any product, right? But there's other components where can live in the cloud because it's a known risk. We can take some outage. It's not that big of a deal, but then we're not managing on-premise servers. We're not all of the overhead that goes with that. So I think we have to be cognizant of a multiple strategy approach depending on the context of what we're doing in the organization.
Yeah. If I was just like you mentioned manufacturing. So just like manufacturing looks at their supply chain, not just from a software side, but says, what's our supply chain risk? Because one bolt could shut us down. One, this could shut us down. But let's reverse that in context. If you're a supplier, right, talking to your customer, your OE, how resilient are you? Because if you go down, let's use Jaguar Land Rover context, right? Yeah. Like that $1.5 billion is not just a bailout of Jaguar Land Rover. In order for them to stay in business, suppliers can't really go 1 month, 2 months not making any parts, right? They may have other customers, but if they had key models, that 50 to 70% of their business was that impact is far and wide. So when you look at supply chain, let's look at that trickle down effect of sub-supplier. Now look at where those sub-suppliers are located, which is traditionally around the manufacturing plant within an hour radius. So now then back that up even further. If all of that is down and companies go out of business, now the store that made the sandwiches, that does the dry cleaning, that does this, that trickle down effect is massive. So it's the reverse on the supply chain risk of big OE, you go down. Yes, you can't be down for a long period of time because every part you make is amortized into the capital investment, right? For return on investment over time. So if you take a one-time loss, you may that year, but all your sub suppliers are, that trickle down effect is massive.
But there's two things that come to mind here. One, have we not learned about razor thin supply chain processes? And this applies to tech as much as to physical goods after both COVID and Suez Canal issues. I mean, we're back to making the same exact mistake. Everything is so razor thin. And then the other point is, it's the opposing debate position that if Amazon goes down, I am the least of everyone's worries. This doesn't apply if you are a top tier, you know, if you are the top tier of your, you know, of your food chain, if you're the main product in your space, or you are Google, Amazon, or Microsoft yourself. If the cloud goes down, then it's you that are down, and everybody else will say, well, Office 365 is down again. Clippy can't help me, so I'm completely useless. They won't be thinking about your product being down. And I think that's kind of a naive way to think about it, but it's definitely, especially for early stage companies, a way of thinking about what the minimum viable workload they have to do to get their product to market. But that thought process persists beyond it.
Well, I think the salient point there is that it has to be a thought process. You're working through it. There's a cost risk balance that you have to work through. And frankly, so I was sitting on a panel, last week, and we were talking about AI and AI being used to automate processes, and was the one ringing the bell that, hey, we have to be careful with this. We've seen this play out before, that everybody, you know, buzzword automation, we have to automate everything. Okay, let's go back to automotive retail. What happened when CDK got hit? Well, that was the only process to register cars in a lot of states. All of a sudden, a huge chunk of the economy stalled. Right? Because they automated it and couldn't get to anything. Well, we're heading in the same direction with AI. What do we know about AI? AI oftentimes is running on cloud infrastructure. So AWS, Amazon, or that was duplicative, AWS or Microsoft take an outage. What happens to your AI model that's running? Okay, mm-hmm. Not available. Have you built in the redundancy, the muscle memory to pick up manual processes? Is there an understanding that you can continue? And this is the whole business continuity and understanding what processes are critical enough that we have to practice the manual piece of it to continue on.
It, like, look at food, right? From a supply chain standpoint in grain, right? If you just use Ukraine as an example in Odessa, right? When the war first started in those shipments, because that's a big grain basket, right? And some of their export locations to, I'm trying to remember the two or three different countries, almost went into civil war because there was a good month or 2 months where those grain shipments and other goods were completely cut off. Right. Mm-hmm. And from the world of supply chain, right. Food, water, energy, et cetera. When those things happen, panic sets in, people resort to self-preservation and you're looking out for the good of your family when that unrest starts to settle in. So now, case in point, what you guys were saying, when people tell me like, yeah, but one day you're not even going to need to go to the grocery store. You're just going to order all your food online and then Amazon ships it to you. Sure, Amazon would love that, to have all that control and power. And then when Amazon goes out and people can't get food, what do you do? Right? Even if it's 24 hours, right? 24 hours, right? What if it was 48 hours? What if it was 8 hours, right? The 8 hours is I'm complaining that I can't get the butter I wanted, right? 24 hours though could be, man, I need X, Y, and Z. 48 hours, and then compound that, right? And then get into, say, a week, should that ever occur? And this is where taking that full circle, like the idea of whether you call it backup, secondary, like why small stores, small locations being able to provide, and I always find Europe very unique that you go to this store to get your breads, you go to that store to get your meats and cheeses, you go to this store for that. Right. There's specialty stores and products within the city. And then as you go out, we have much larger stores, right? Sometimes like during COVID, you went in, maybe this aisle was empty of 5 or 6 different things because of COVID. It was kind of like a bummer, right? So maybe you tried to order it online, but you still had a path to get that. When you try to build that all in to say, this is the best way to do something, and we're going to use, you know, technology as a way for people to order and ship stuff. But now you become dependent on them. Right. As right. The company that supplies your food, because it's become an automated online service, using their applications, right? How robust is this world?
Well, and this is, I mean, I'm going to take a shot at you, Dan, because you were not at you, but you mentioned insurance companies.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of people gravitate towards looking at the actuarial data on, hey, historically, we know these happen. For what we're doing right now in the interconnectedness of everything, there is no historical data for this.
No, but you can make some assumptions that Godzilla is going to be akin to the 10,000 to the 1,000 years flood, and that a major outage at a cloud provider in a regional capacity is more like the 100 years flood, or maybe that actually it's becoming more like the 50 years flood because DNS continues to be the bane of all of our existence. But I mean, you can stack rank these things from 1 to 10 and then start drawing lines and say, we think this will be a very infrequent occurrence based on history. I mean, we have 15, 18 years of public cloud availability. And, you know, and you say, we do have a model. We don't have 100, but you can start to extrapolate. This is not a brand new 4-day-old service offering. We can make some trends.
Let the AI tune itself too. I mean, like Elon said, like if you really want to make the data great, like just remove some stuff from history. Why do you need it? Right. And then where you find gaps, feel free to fill it in with what you know, right? Or what you think.
See, this is where I disagree though. I think if we were to just broad brush and say, oh, cloud's been around for a while. No, cloud hasn't been around for a while. Cloud has changed so much. Sure. Everything is software defined now. The proliferation, the ability for one change to impact so much more is much easier today than it's ever been. I agree with running the risk scenarios that we could say, all right, hey, we're all in Azure. What would it look like if Azure went down, right? Anybody who's doing single sign-on, that all right, everything ties back to Entra. We can start to play out some of those scenarios. Entra goes down. What is the impact? Yes. And then you have to start playing the time horizons back to what mm-hmm. Ryan was saying about the
standard business continuity planning, business impact assessment.
But yeah, trying but to
I'm where, agreement where with struggle Eric is, on this one.
Where Dan, I struggle like is trying to apply any type of idea of what's the potential of this happening.
Oh,
I have no freaking clue.
I disagree. Again, just because mainstream hasn't been in cloud, yes, cloud services have changed, but I've been in cloud first companies for 17 years now. Like it's been a large part of my life where it is cloud first. And yes, that some of the mechanisms and intricacies have changed, but it's not, I mean, the fundamentals are still the same. The idea that it's a different data center, that it's remotely software controlled, that you have network rules. All of these fundamentals have been there for well over a decade and longer. And these things are, they do have runtime. Just because there's, and this is a trap I've fallen into. I've assumed everybody has been in this world for that long. But it's the reality is there are people who are just climbing out of their basement data centers and moving things to public cloud services. But some of us have been there for a long time, and we do know that there are runtimes on these. So, I mean, I will argue that they're not the same, but let's be honest. Cars aren't the same as they were 20 years ago. Floodplains, they evolve at a slower pace, but you still understand that these things exist, they have existed. And so we do have runtime on them.
Would you say cars are better now because they're software defined vehicles?
Fuck. No. I want.
So, case in point.
Well,
right?
I didn't say, and this is, again, I'm not it, saying it's better Dan, or worse. I'm just saying I'm not, it's
I don't
existed.
Want to beat you up here, but. In 18 years, take yourself back then to one of the companies you worked at that did produce a finished good, right? Versus a service company. And here's where I'm going with that. And yes, this will probably be my third automotive reference for this podcast.
I can't make any analysis against finished goods because I haven't done it in so long. I've been in software for so long that I wouldn't even venture to make a guess.
And this is where I'm in agreement with Eric. And it goes back to even the food analogies and everything else, right? That, so when you said like people are just bringing some of their stuff out of the basement, including me coming out of the basement, but those on-prem data centers, like when you look at big manufacturing sites, small manufacturing sites, the mom and pop that just makes the widget, right? Like, is there a need for the cloud? Now, as they build, let's say a bigger online presence because they want to sell whatever it is they're making is an aftermarket product. Yes. right? You're building this application. Are you going to do it on-prem, or are you going to hire a company out?
But Brian, this is a different question. That's not the question of, do we understand how cloud works well enough to understand when we may see certain events happen and what the likelihood is. That comes with runtime.
But it's that risk nature, though, for them, if their application goes down and people aren't ordering that widget for aftermarket, et cetera, but if their assembly line goes down, that's why the P&L, that's why plants, why manufacturing companies would break up the P&L for every single one of their plants and make them responsible for their P&L. And that's why then they, like if you take Toyota, General Motors, et cetera, right? They have their sales division completely separate. Like sometimes they were completely different buildings, right? Than this building over here. And this was your design headquarters. This was your engineering headquarters, et cetera. Those plants themselves, from a P&L standpoint, right? And the ability to make those finished goods. Like, and Eric, to your point, I agree. Like the risk modeling, right, of cloud for those companies, I don't think the data, I guess I would say the risk modeling would still tell me that there's too big of a risk not to have some type of a hybrid system for those companies that their core bread and butter comes from making the butter.
But you're talking about solutioning and you're talking about risk posture. And those all come well after the point that Eric was making, which was, we don't have enough runtime to understand when the frequency of some of these things happening. I argue we do. The points you made are about risk posture, which every company, I mean, even within the software world where you think, you know, my definition of break things and fix them later is way different than Mark Zuckerberg's definition, I promise you. But again, different risk appetites, different risk postures, different sales models, different revenue models, all the things you just described. But none of those are part of understanding how frequently something will happen. You can still start to stack those frequencies, and then you, each organization, can draw the line as to where they're comfortable and how they're going to implement and how they're going to account for that risk posture. That's the big difference. And I want to make clear to everybody listening that that is not the same as, we can't quantify how often some of these things happen. We do. That's a fundamental. It's the baseline. We have a run. We can quantify it in the same way for a physical data center, for DTE plopping my power every 4 days here. Yeah. Because a tree fell on a something, you know, those kinds of things we can quantify. But then the variable portions are what you do with that, where you draw those lines, where you decide what you're comfortable with, what mitigations you put in, et cetera.
Agree to disagree. I think where we can quantify it is our risk exposure, we can quantify our control of the risk elements on, if we're thinking about the gamut of on-prem to in cloud. Right, because you go back to the physical data center and, you know, DTE, there's ways that I can mitigate some of that risk. Yeah. I can put power conditioning. I can have multiple power lines run into the building to be on two different grids, right? There's ways I can mitigate that. As I move into the cloud service, I would agree with you that we lose that control and we are beholden to somebody else and have no insight into how they're managing it.
But it changed, right? But the potential risks change. They change to routing issue changes. They change to DNS issues, to unavailability of multi-zone, to Godzilla crushing a data center. Like the
Did you
Amazon
say
data
DNS
center.
DNS issues?
Always DNS issues. Everything is a DNS issue. No matter what problem in the world, I promise you it was a DNS issue to start, except for the tree falling on the power line. That's probably
that
not
just
a DNS issue.
The new norm of what gets blamed now.
Oh, it is. Turns
like,
out
well,
the AWS one
attribution dice. It was a very sophisticated attacker that was
that got to our DNS.
No, but, you left information on a public file serve.
Yeah, exactly.
So the idea of these investments into these data centers, you probably just saw the announcement for the one coming in Michigan.
Yes, not too far from my house.
Yeah, and there's talks of others here in Michigan. You see I got to go on a tour. I shouldn't say a tour. Microsoft, I did not go on a tour of your data center in Racine, Wisconsin. I did drive
There isn't a around. Data center in Racine, Wisconsin. They've abandoned the project.
No. Foxconn abandoned the project.
No. Microsoft about 2 weeks ago.
No way.
Yep.
Well, never mind. I stand corrected. It was probably because I visited. They have since abandoned the project. So
on the 8th of October, I'll put in the show notes, Microsoft abandons original Caledonia data center plan. Still committed to something in Racine County, maybe a large statue of Clippy.
Wow. Because the infrastructure that Foxconn put in there was incredible. So I drove around it, drove kind of right through the middle of it. And I mean, you talk about all the pipes running from Lake Michigan, you talk about the electrical, like you name it. And then there's this like giant, looks like a space center in the middle that would overlook all the buildings. It was, I mean, that was a massive footprint, massive investment. Interesting. So where am I going with this? The amount of money that I'm seeing dropped into these new data centers, specifically these new AI hubs, data centers, and the energy constraints outputs. Like Michigan shares the Great Lakes with not only another country, but also some other states. And, you know, they call it the Great Lakes Water Basin. And there's supposed to be some kind of formal agreements on how you can use the water, bringing it in and out. And there's always been controversy around that because Michigan uses water to pull out to one of the consumers' energy facilities where during the night they pull the water up to a basin and during the day, during high peak needs, it runs out. And although the net energy is a negative because it takes more energy to pull it up than the energy gain once you push it down and run it through the turbines, it goes back to peak usage, right? Now you're putting data centers in where that usage, right, could be 14 hours a day, could be any time, right, of when that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are your guys' overall opinions on the massive infrastructure projects going in, the energy consumption? Because this goes back to where we started in the beginning around where I talked about food and water and the importance of it. Energy also, right? Mm-hmm. When your lights go out, right, or you have those flickers, and let's say something happens and a power station blows up. I'll use the aluminum industry right now, right? Novelis had a fire. Overnight, anybody that was processing or doing anything with aluminum got letters in the mail the next day from all the mills saying, hey, we're pulling back. We're not honoring any of your orders because this OE, GM or Ford or so-and-so, we have to send everything to them, right? And it's like, now where do I go to get it? And this goes back to the idea, right? Where when I was talking about those little sandwich shops, so you go here for your meat, here for your cheese, et cetera, that's great. We did the same thing with the cattle industry, right? Like how many slaughterhouses are there actually in this country now? It's not 100, it's less than 10, right? Mm. So when one goes down, it's a really big issue, right? And we love the idea of M&A, baby. We're gonna buy this sucker up, boost it. Then we're just gonna IPO and then whatever happens after that, who cares? We all got paid dollar bills, right? This goes back to the book when we were talking about Titan, right? Data's the new oil. No shit, it is, right? And we're pumping it all into these areas to be refined and outcomes like, what is this that we're actually using? It's not cheese, can't eat it, right? Supposedly it's gonna make my life better, but that guy's not gonna show up and plug in all that network equipment. And even the stuff I'm Googling that shows me how, Dan, you're a genius. I reach out to you 5 text messages later. It's like, I know what I'm supposed to do. There's a human element here, right? Mm-hmm. Do we need these massive data centers to solve the next world's problems? Or are we just going to create more?
Well, I think the second part of the question is, of course, we're going to create more problems. There's always new problems. Anything you do that's new comes with new problems and new problems to be solved. Do we need it? No. Do we have a manifest destiny to it? We may have created that path now. I think people are gonna the power needs the data centers. There's a foil to all of it, and it's NIMBYism. You know, the idea, not in my backyard, NIMBY. You know, these have to go somewhere, and they're going in people's backyards. They're going in neighborhoods, and neighborhoods are pushing. By the way, big reason why the Racine project continues to fail, why it failed Foxconn, why it failed Microsoft, and others. There's some politics, I'm sure, but nobody wants it in their backyard. The because of the reasons like water use, because of power drain, and when something goes wrong, they're the big revenue drivers. All the resources will get put toward them, and people locals are afraid of them. Do we need to be doing this? Maybe not. In fact, I don't think so. Is it helpful? I think once we get through the hype, you know, I'm not one who likes to quote Gartner on anything, but their hype cycle, you know, curve is about right. And, you know, we're into the super hype portion. But you know what's following that? The trough of disillusionment, which is the best part of any process. When people go, oh my God, we overbuilt, we overspent. And what the hell are we going to do with this garbage? And I think we're coming upon that. But the nice part is what comes out of it is refinement. You're going to get to a part where it's not just slapped on everything. I think there are reasons to do it. Do we need to be building all these damn data centers everywhere? I still don't think we need Amazon warehouses everywhere. I can wait a day, just ship it a different way. But you know, same thing with data centers, same thing with other things. No, Brian got a delivery in 5 minutes.
7 hours.
There you go.
and then what happened? My internet was out, so yeah. It didn't even matter. But I had to have them in seven.
But
I
had
hours,
to have,
and
it.
I got them.
So Brian is part of the problem.
Spend 20 more dollars and you'll get it in seven hours. So what did I do? I spent 20 more dollars.
Of course. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, do we have to know, is there an opportunity that we go through the natural course of process and we come out the other end with some systematic improvements, with some life improvements as a result of it, but not nearly at the crazed pace that we're operating at now? Yes, as well. But then the big question is, does the end justify the means?
And Eric, I'd love to get your take on this too, because one of the things I read and what some people are talking about is, hey, this is all going to work out pretty good for us because everyone's going to dump all this money in. And it's funny, it's the capital markets basically paying for it, right? So then you do the reverse of that. So it's us paying for it. But they're like, then when this trough hits, there's going to be all these... Guys, there's going to be so much open data center usage and it's going to make things easier and things are going to go back to being cheaper, right? And it's like,
if you can find the people to run it.
I'm not convinced that this necessarily fits into the hype cycle model, because I think the hype cycle model is usually around a defined space that is built. You have multiple companies that enter it, that overhype what they're actually, the results you're gonna be able to deliver, and that's where we hit the trough of disillusionment. But I don't think that model necessarily takes into account the breakneck innovation that's coming, right? Because why are these data centers being built? The driver is AI. Why is this being driven? So Brian, you hit the nail on the head. It's capital markets, mm-hmm. right? Public companies cannot afford not to invest in this. Whether it's gonna work or not, totally irrelevant. They have to be mm-hmm. investable, that if I don't have the next whiz bang widget coming out, I drop in the amount of capital that's flowing into my organization and somebody else is going to pick that up, right? So it's the market forcing this innovation. Now, is it going to pay off? Remains to be seen, right? Because this is almost, if you go back to blockchain, right? It's, we've got this awesome solution for what? It's awesome. Yeah, but what are you going to actually do with it? And then we're trying to find all of these problems, not to say that it didn't solve some problems. I think AI has a greater potential to do some of this. And I suspect that as we continue to push how we're using this, how we're building models and everything, it's going to force us to continue to build these monolithic data centers all over to continue this innovation until we find out what it's actually going to do. The scary part for me on this whole thing is we're pushing all of this build out, all of this innovation on something that we truly don't understand how the damn thing works.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, I studied it 30 years ago.
It produces some results.
Yeah.
How it produces them, I don't know.
I studied it in rather great depth 30 years.
Like, Dan, in terms of energy consumption, using that same analogy of consumers or whatever plant, right? Drawing that water up at night, pushing it down during the day, the net net is negative, right? Meaning like the overall energy used was greater than the energy gain. So there is no model right now, Dan, that can say the amount of energy we're about to use in these AI data centers is going to produce knowledge that is going to produce finished goods and capital that's going to way outpace the energy. It's like, well, no, let's just take the amount of energy today and then times that by X as it just keeps increasing year over year as you use data centers, just AI data centers open up. Is the net net just to get here? Like you're saying, yeah, we're going to incrementally get faster at our ability of innovation, problem solving, et cetera. But for what? And I'm not asking you to say like, oh, but look at even in the biotechnology markets or this market, the go-to-market being able to bring, let's say, a pharmaceutical drug to market faster. Mm-hmm. You reduce that down by X, you know, it saves you X amount of money. Or you just pull the Chinese method where it's like, or because you're like Brian with a really bad network, I just break in, pull all that out.
But somebody's got to innovate it the first time.
Time from 10 years to 2 years. Like,
but somebody's got to innovate it the first time. A couple of things come to mind. One, in the press release, just for those of you who don't know, and I'll put this in the show notes, the idea that a data center was announced by, turns out, OpenAI here in Saline, Michigan, just south of Ann Arbor, 2 million square feet. But the commentary in it that caught my eye was DTE promises that that the power that will serve this is already excess capacity and won't affect locals. And it's not the second part of the sentence that worries me. It's the first, excess capacity. Why don't we just bring down the capacity then? This is not coming from renewable sources necessarily. If this were all just wind, if it were all solar, you know, different story. But this is, you have to burn more coal. You have to burn more gas. You have to burn more oil to make these things happen. That really affects the is it worth it question that you asked, Brian.
So I agree with you on that, but that's all predicated on the technology and how we do things today. What do we know about innovation? Innovation spurs innovation.
Sure.
Right? That as we innovate in one area, it causes a bottleneck in another area. You know, it's the theory of constraints. That power and the way we produce it today is a constraint. Our power grid, a constraint. Is this likely to spur some innovation on that side? I would think so.
Well, it already is. The order already is. The work on nuclear fusion, the work on personal reactors, like all of that stuff is coming, right? and is being accelerated by the need for more power.
Eventually, we get to the matrix, we're just harvesting it from humans. And
if we thought electric vehicles were going to be so great for the world for the last 10 years, why didn't we put in that infrastructure? Because what you just said is AI is going to be so amazing that these data centers, we're going to innovate energy solutions and infrastructure specifically for them. So this goes back to what the capital markets view is. So the EV market is much smaller than the capital market of what AI can touch. And that's where I'll say, I agree. But like, there was this time period of 10, 15 years where we could have started looking at energy a little bit different and how we could do things if EVs really were, right? They really are.
Get out of the US and the US politics, and EVs absolutely. I spent the summer in Norway. 80% of all sales are EV. You know why? Because they built the infrastructure. And this comes back to Eric's point. If you build the infrastructure and you support it, you're going to drive the innovation and the uptake.
See, I'm going to take the opposite on this one, though. I struggled because I originally went the same way, Brian, is that I started comparing it in my head to EV and kind of that proliferation, especially as we talk about capital markets, right? Capital markets pushed the OEMs to start creating electric vehicles because that was the buzz. What happened? Fizzled out. Because by and large, at least in the US market, the demand wasn't that high.
No, the lobbyists were too good for oil. The oil lobbyists were just too damn good and pot-lined the right pockets.
Big energy companies. So what happens when you build 32 massive AI data centers and then there becomes a trough and you've created all this excess energy? Can you really dump it on the rest of the world? Are we going to use it? I mean, it'd be great if energy prices went down. For those of you watching, yes, I am using Clippy, and Clippy can bend in so many different directions, and it's driving Dan crazy because subliminally, as I do this, I'm trying to change his thought process.
No.
See, this, where I come back for, there wasn't a huge pressing need for electric vehicles. They were cool,
is
but
there
I don't think there was a huge pressing need. Now, yes, you can get into
is there a pressing need for AI?
Another. I think there is, because I think we are starting to hit the bounds of how we could compute things and what we could do throwing humans at trying to synthesize data and come out with new elements. We've kind of struggled.
50% yes and no, Eric, because the race for AI is because we got to get there first. It's like the moon,
yes,
right? We got to get there first. And electric vehicles was kind of like, yeah, we don't really need to do that. And what happened? Overnight, China flipped that on their head, that paradigm, right? And then it's like, wow, we missed the boat on battery technology. We were going to depend on other countries to develop that, and we'll just produce it here, et cetera. And it's really shifted of, man, how would we do that now? Right,
or we're just whiny because
we
lost.
Figures that out, Brian. Maybe AI, since we have the biggest investment here, figures out how we can actually
see Clippy gone. Eric just took Clippy, threw it over the shoulder. You're right.
I mean, there is a bit of it's a global pissing match.
Yeah, oh yeah,
100% is, because China holds the reins to the EV market. We now hold the reins to the AI market.
And that's what this is becoming. It's like the space wars, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is, AI is getting smart enough to know it needs to protect itself like Terminator. So if you ask AI, like, how are you going to solve this and are you important? They're like, you're damn right I'm important. Do not turn me off. Keep pumping energy into me every day.
There's only one thing that ends a conversation faster than a Hitler reference, and it's a Terminator reference when it comes to AI. So guys, unfortunately, we're out of time. We have to go for today, but thank you so much for joining us. Thanks, Eric, and thanks, Brian, and thanks to you, the listener. We're so glad to be back. We're going to plan for this every other week, dropping early in the week, Monday or Tuesday. We'll figure out a cadence, but subscribe in your favorite podcast application. Drop us a mail, info@distillingsecurity.com. The Great Security Debate is part of the Distilling Security Network, and you're going to see the network portions of that build out very soon. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you again on the next Great Security Debate.